An update on working with narcissists on this edition of Audio Digest Psychology, Volume 7, Issue 17, for September 7, 2018. Working with narcissistic clients, presented by Wendy Beharry, Clinical Training Director at the Cognitive Therapy Center of New Jersey and the Schema Therapy Institute of New Jersey and New York City. Ms. Beharry is interviewed by the editor of Audio Digest Psychology, Nora McCready.
Wendy, first of all, thank you very much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me, Nora.
Can you tell me, first of all, how did you become interested in narcissism and working with narcissists?
Well, it really happened by chance, I would say. When working with certain types of clients, I was finding myself getting triggered, meaning I felt like I was losing my footing. I felt as if I had dropped into a time-warped state of mind where I was responding in ways that were just not characteristic of me, meaning I was giving into demands. I was feeling a little intimidated and put off, and that's not my personality. That's not typical of me when I'm in my healthy adult stance. So I was curious about my own reactions to certain types of clients, and lo and behold, came to understand a little bit more about narcissistic personality disorder, the way it shows up, and what happens to us on the other side when we're faced with someone who has these traits, which can be demeaning and critical and controlling and show-offish and charming and demanding and entitled. And noticed that when I'm with them, something happens inside of me. And I'm at the same time learning about an approach to psychotherapy called schema therapy, which looks at how life themes, emotional life themes that live in memory, live in the body, get activated under certain conditions. And I thought, oh, isn't this interesting? This is where mine are getting activated, right here in working with this population.
Is this something that is unique to narcissists or to people with narcissistic personality disorder, this whole phenomenon of triggering?
Oh, yeah, they are the masters of triggering. I think they are probably one of the most difficult people to engage with comes to emotional, intimate relationships. I mean, they can be amazing in terms of their performance as experts in the field. But if you're working closely with them in a more emotional or intimate setting, be it a collegial relationship at times, especially in the romantic or primary relationship, for sure, they can be incredibly overwhelming and intimidating and also dismissive and detached, leaving you feeling very erased, very alone. In the treatment room, they are probably one of the most challenging types of clients that therapists will face because they can activate therapists' own schemas, life themes, and leave them feeling incompetent, inadequate, frustrated, and often just either changing the subject, avoiding the accountability issue that's so necessary in treating them, giving in to their demands, being wooed by their charmingness. You know, they can be very charming. So yeah, it's very typical with narcissism.
Can you define the difference between what we call narcissism and narcissistic personality disorder? And would you differ in your clinical approach?
Only in terms of where to place the emphasis. I'm answering the second question first. Narcissistic personality disorder is the clinical diagnosis. This is the accepted clinical diagnosis that goes back through DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Diagnoses of Emotional and Mental Health Issues. And so it takes into account the full range of traits of narcissism that I look at, and my colleagues who work in the same way that I do, we look at as happening along a spectrum. So if you figure in that all of these traits, including the self-aggrandizing traits and the fantasy of extraordinariness and specialness, and you know, the sense of entitlement to do what I want, the rules don't apply to me, the origins even to some degree would be part of how we characterize someone with narcissistic personality disorder. So it's the more formal diagnosis. In layman's terms, narcissism, which is not an actual clinical diagnosis, it's just a term that's being used to capture the essence of someone who has some of these traits. And I outline them in my book. I talk about the 13 traits that tend to be most prominent when we're dealing with narcissists. And some people have some of them, some have many of them, some have all of them. And in the clinical setting, what matters most is if you're dealing with someone who is more covert in their narcissism, meaning that, and again, I'm using the term more as a shorthand, but someone who shows up in a more covert form, meaning that they don't necessarily have all of the traits that you'd find in NPD, in the personality disorder, but they have some of them and enough of them that it has become deleterious to their lifestyle, damaging to their relationships. Covert narcissists can show up more as martyrs and victims of others and have more outstanding pain than the next person. They can be more passive aggressive in the way that they deal with problem solving and feeling put off or feeling dismissed or feeling rejected. So it's just a matter of where the emphasis gets placed in terms of reconciling whatever needs that have not been successfully met for this individual in their early life experience and early life development. And that might be a bit complicated the way I'm describing it, but it's more in when I'm speaking from the point of view of a schema therapist. So much of my own work and my experience, although I've been trained in other models, is informed by this particular approach to treatment, one that we have found to be highly effective when dealing with personality disorders, and one that I find to be quite effective in working with issues of narcissism.
Okay, well, that is a very nice segue into my next question, which is, please describe schema therapy, and specifically the development of early maladaptive schemas.
Yeah, schema therapy, again, with my bias very clear and out here, it's really a gorgeous and elegant model in that it provides the therapist with a means for conceptualizing, really making sense out of, really putting the pieces together to create this narrative understanding of their client's needs from A to Z, meaning we're looking to understand, what is it like to be you? What is it like to be you, to be in your skin, to live in your bones? And how did you develop this part of yourself? We're looking at everything from possible biologic predisposition to the way they entered the world, to how they related with family members, to peer groups, to teachers and other important others out there in their universe, to particular memories that are outstanding, particular biases in the way they look at themselves and their relationship to the world, and maybe, you know, how that was formed, how that developed, how they coped. So the early maladaptive schema is basically what we would think of as a core life theme. I mean, schemas are, we all have schemas. We have positive ones. We have negative ones. It's schemata. It's basic themes or feelings that live within the self about ourselves, about the future, about our relationships with others. The early maladaptive schema, we have 18 of them in our model, is specifically those that pertain to unmet early childhood needs. So, for example, the need for safety and protection and to be free of harm or to have someone who cares for you when you're in harm's way, when that's missing, that need, that basic need for protection and safety, one can develop a mistrust or a mistrust and abuse schema. If you've been abused, if you've been used, if you've been manipulated and you haven't received the kind of reconciliation in the form of safety and protection and comfort, one develops this mistrust and abuse schema. If you've been rejected or abandoned, if you have been subject to moving around the planet one too many times, knowing the needs of a little child for healthy development and actualization in their adult life, the need for a steady and sturdy attachment, a healthy attachment to their caregivers and to the world ultimately, we know that stability is very important. So when the life of the child is based in the instability of loss or lots of coming and going and a lack of predictability, they can develop potentially an abandonment schema. Now, this isn't all, you know, an absolute one-to-one ratio. If this happens, the schema develops. Not necessarily, because we also know there's a thing called constitution and one's personal makeup and temperament and the possibility of resolution based on maybe a lovely grandma who was standing by filling in some of the pieces. But when schemas develop, it's because there's a need that has not been met. And that interplay between our biology and our environment speaks largely for how we develop these early maladaptive schemas. The quick example with narcissists is that, you know, we hypothesize and we learn from what they teach us and with regards to their own personal narratives that, you know, very often a child comes into the world with a highly sensitive temperament, for example. So not only do they need the ordinary things that every little one needs, affection and protection and guidance and support and encouragement and playfulness, but they may need it even more. And if they are born to an environment where the caregivers are depressed or distracted, not necessarily bad people, but just not accessible, not available in the way the child needs, you can see the beginnings, the origins of these unmet needs that form not only a thought, like a cognition, but an experience within the body, an emotional, physical experience that can lead to these life themes of you can't count on people to be there for you, and people are going to go away anyway. And maybe if I was, I don't know, smarter, more handsome, more beautiful, more fun, more interesting, I would have gotten more attention. So I'm probably broken and defective, and people are going to end up using you and hurting you. So you see the beginning of the evolution of early maladaptive schemas based on certain unmet needs and other dictates that may have come from the family, like, for example, with narcissists, lots of emphasis on performance, not enough emphasis on connection.
Are there early maladaptive schemas that apply specifically to narcissists?
Yeah, that's a good question. We do tend to see, as we do with every personality disorder, certain trends, certain profiles of schemas that will be more relevant for certain types of people. And of course, there's exceptions to every one of these. And we all have schemas, by the way. Everyone has schemas. It's just, you know, sometimes they're dormant, sometimes somewhere along the way they get healed, either through therapy, through good friends, other good caregivers. But we all have them. You know, we know that parenting is one of the hardest jobs on the planet, and not every need can be adequately fulfilled. And so, you know, no one is immune to developing early maladaptive schemas. Narcissists are most likely to have a profile that would include the number one schema, although entitlement is certainly a number one schema for them, but on parallel with that would be defectiveness. So despite their very, you know, bold and blustery personalities that look larger than life, often what you're dealing with is someone who underneath all of that is highly insecure, feels flawed, feels undesirable, feels uncomfortable and awkward when it comes to intimacy and real true emotional closeness. So they carry a big defectiveness shame schema. There's a lot of shame around the longings for the kinds of connection as a child that typically are not well met, or they're dismissed, or they're berated for showing these signs of weakness by being needy, by having reasonable needs, I should say. So defectiveness is one. Emotional deprivation, the idea of counting on people for getting your emotional needs met, that's another schema. Social isolation, because they are rather awkward in social, they can be charming and they can be entertaining, but when it comes to really engaging in the give and take, the reciprocity of a healthy relationship, or even just a healthy social connection, they're awkward. They're not so good at that. they become uncomfortable. It's a place where they can get triggered. So they have another schema where they feel different, usually on the outside of things. Sometimes that's due to also the fact that they may have been the kid who was the, you know, the superstar when it came to playing an instrument or athletic prowess or academic skillfulness. So they have these extraordinary qualities when it comes to performance and doing, but they're a little awkward when it comes to being, and they can get picked on. They can feel used as opposed to feeling really connected. They develop this mistrust schema because they expect people to use them and take advantage of them because their deprivation schema says that no one's really interested in just caring about you for you. They work hard. They have high unrelenting standard schema, which means, you know, enough is not enough. It always has to be the best, better, better, better. They live very dichotomously through this lens of be extraordinary or be nothing. And it's hard for them to live in the world of average and ordinary. That's somewhat prohibitive. So they have an unrelenting standard schema, which keeps them, you know, kind of running all the time. They're at high risk for things like workaholism and other types of excessive behaviors, which can be addictions or at least excessive preoccupation, whether it's with drugs, alcohol, sexual encounters on the internet, pornography addiction, things of that sort. They do tend to be more hypersexual. Narcissists tend in their profile of schemas, the ways in which they cope with or try to avoid the emotional turmoil that will come when they get triggered is to either detach, meaning they just shut down. They look for ways of distracting themselves through stimulating activity. Usually it's the things I've mentioned and even more, shopping and spending and eating, but it's typically through stimulating activity, or they're busy in their kind of self-aggrandizing approval-seeking modes where they're looking for everyone's attention, everyone's approval, trying to be the best, competing, charming, can be very courtly even when they're in that mode. But much of this is to cover up and to try to suppress that pain that's connected with these underlying schemas. So emotional deprivation, defectiveness, social isolation, unrelenting standards, a sense of entitlement, which comes often if they're not the spoiled type who've just been taught that they don't have to play by the same rules as everyone else, which would be more of a pure form of the entitlement schema, they develop the entitlement schema as a compensation for their sense of defectiveness, for their feelings of awkwardness and isolation and loneliness. And their entitlement will have them be, you know, they'll show up a little haughty. Like, I've earned my right, I've worked hard and I'm the best, and I shouldn't have to play by the same rules, and I should be entitled to special privileges, and it is my way or the highway. So reciprocity is really very, very difficult for them. And these are some of the primary schemas that you're likely to see in their profile.
This sounds a little bit analogous to the core beliefs in CBT.
Yeah, except that it's more than a belief. It's so much more than a belief because it carries the weight of memory, emotional memory, bodily sensation, impulse to react, to respond. You know, it really lives more holistically in the whole system. So it's more than just a belief, although beliefs are part of schemas because there is language that goes with each one of these early maladaptive schemas. And the beliefs that are part of them are very rigid and highly exaggerated. So there's some similarity, except there's more than that. It's even more exaggerated. It's even deeper in their core memory.
What would be the goals of treatment when working with a narcissist?
Well, the primary goal when we use this model is to meet the needs that weren't met, which may sound a bit outlandish at first glance because, you know, as the narcissist would say, but the past is in the past and you can't change the past. What I would say is, you're right, we can't change what actually happened, but what we can do in therapy is change the way it's been organized in your mind, in your nervous system, in the way you relate to the world. So it goes something like this, where I might say, you see, your dad may have said those words to you. You know, your mom said you could do no wrong. Your dad said everything you did, although it was damn near perfect, was still not good enough. And so you were very confused. And the truth is, okay, that happened. We can't change the fact that it happened, but the problem is that you believe it. The problem is that you carry it as a truth, the message that was embedded in your dad's approach and in your mom's approach. The message that was embedded is that it'll never be good enough. You always have to try harder. The message that's embedded is that when someone acts nice to you, they must want something from you because your mom would use you sort of as a trophy for her own ego. And what you did was you walked away from that experience, not your fault, it's just what happens, believing this all to be true. That's the part that we can change, because what you really needed was someone to love you really just for you, and someone who could accept you as you were and guide you and support you and play with you and allow you to just be a little child and not have to be the master of the universe by the age of 8 years old. And that we can change. We can meet that need by way of the imagination, by way of the connection in this therapy relationship between me and that vulnerable part of you. So it's a kind of adaptive reparenting of the early experience that we're putting into play. And it's really using this fabulous resource of the imagination to feel and to sense and to smell and to taste and to touch and to just as vividly and vibrantly as possible reorganize the way it was supposed to be, allowing them to experience at a very sensory, skin felt level the idea of really being held, you know, by imagining and picturing it and confronting criticisms that were unfair in the imagination and altering the way things happened in the imagination. It doesn't mean it replaces what really happened, but what gets replaced is the meanings and the truths, and the extension of that, of course, is the emotional experiences that got ascribed to those early life events. And that's the goal in the therapy. And the therapy relationship is a very, very important and powerful agent for change. And as the therapist, I'm working hard to connect with the most vulnerable part of my client and to teach them and help them to develop a healthy, loving adult part of themselves that can care for this vulnerable part as well. Because once they know that they are fine as they are, that they don't have to prove anything, that they don't have to impress, that they don't have to win the approval of everyone they come into contact with. Once they know they're fine, these coping modes naturally begin to weaken. And this is hard. I mean, it can sound good and it might make sense as I'm saying it, but it's really, really hard to do. And it does take time. This is not a 10-session fix when you're working with complex personalities.
What would be some of the clinical strategies that you would use to achieve these goals, these outcomes?
Well, the one is imagery. So imagery is essentially what I was talking about. It's the use of the imagination. It doesn't even necessarily require having to remember a specific episode, because we know the brain will inform us in terms of how perception is being mapped and organized in memory. Perception is what we need. I mean, very often clients will remember something as their emotions are getting evoked, but it's not necessary. You know, we can get an image of a little child who is feeling alone or feeling the stress of having to perform, feeling the burden of having to be a surrogate for a parent who was depressed or lonely, feeling that they could never measure up in the eyes of another parent or caregiver, feeling the terror of going to the schoolyard and being picked on because they were small. So these types of experiences, no matter how vivid or how faded and small they are, we can work with them in imagery to begin to reorganize and re-script the way they were experienced to provide the outcome that was needed. So it's all about meeting that unmet need. So imagery is a strong tool for doing that. We talk a lot in schema therapy about modes. So we're looking at these emotional states that humans live in. And narcissists in particular will move between this very highly detached mode where they sort of shut down and they check out and they get distracted. That mode and the mode where they're showing off and they're controlling and they're demanding and they're demeaning. And it's that overcompensating mode where they're more action oriented, and it can go anywhere from charming you to putting you down and making you feel small. But it's a kind of overcompensation that, again, is used to cut away from emotional pain and emotional experiences and vulnerability and exposure to shame. So we do mode work, meaning that we create dialogues. And this is a more cognitive exercise to some degree, where we create dialogues between the different modes of personality and try to help the client to see the ways in which these modes, what the relative strength is of each one, and how they interact with each other to keep the more vulnerable part of them really in abeyance, seemingly protected from the universe, but somewhat paradoxically deprived of being able to be in relationship, especially with their loved ones who just want to know them and just want to share their emotional experiences with them, which is where they get very hung up and tend to have the most problems. So mode work, imagery, again, the therapy relationship, the therapist being sturdy and using an intervention in schema therapy that we call empathic confrontation, meaning that a lot of energy goes into empathizing, not sympathizing, not feeling sorry for them, not simply letting them off the hook. It's not about, you know, just diving into compassion. It's empathy. It's really trying to make sense out of the experience that they've had. And so it boils down to things like, I know in your world that getting everything right, doing your best, being the best you could be would render you permission to, you know, run around and wreak havoc and have no limits, no boundaries, no consequences. As long as you were pulling it off academically, you know, the sky was the limit. And that's what you learned. So that's not your fault, Joe, but it's not how it works in the real world, especially in relationships where people make choices and there's consequences and there's respect for each other's needs and feelings and there's sharing and there's limits and there's boundaries in the relationship. It doesn't work that way. Or it could be something more simply where I'll just say, I know it's not your intention to be disrespectful. I know this is just what you're used to. You know, it's what you do in your boardroom. But it is disrespectful in here in this relationship. And it does have the quality of pushing me away and making it difficult for me to feel the caring that I want to and need to feel for you in order to help you. So I get a sneak peek at what it's like to be someone in your life on a personal level, what it's like for the people out there, although I'm trained to understand you, so I'm not overwhelmed by it, but I get a sense of what it would be like. So you can see how the therapy relationship itself is this small microcosmic world that we're using as something of a representation of what it's like in the world outside. And we're constantly referring back and forth to the experiences of those outside who are struggling with the narcissist.
So it sounds like setting limits and boundaries is an important part of empathic confrontation.
Well, it's a need, you know, and a lot of therapists become uncomfortable with this because they don't want to get into the tangle, you know, of the narcissist getting upset, getting angry, being critical of them, or the need to be, because we have to be, to do this well enough, you have to be persistent and they're going to break the rule. We have to expect that they're going to break the rules because that's what they're used to. So it's a strategy that can be used to try to bypass detachment when they're detached. I know it's uncomfortable to get in touch with your feelings. You were taught that feelings were a sign of weakness. You were taught that any sign of your emotional vulnerability was really a mistake and that people will take advantage of you. I get it. But I'm here to tell you that this is what we need to do in order for you to make the changes that are necessary in order to have a more fulfilling relationship. You are struggling because you keep the best part of yourself tucked away. because that's what you were taught. So there's the empathy with the confrontation. It's, I get it, but sometimes it's to try to draw them out and bypass the detachment. Sometimes it's to set a limit with the parts of them that can be really unruly or entitled or demanding or too critical. So we can use it for a number of different ways to try to connect with them and to set a limit. The setting a limit can feel like it's issuing a punishment, but it's not a punishment. It's really what they need, because so many of them, these types of individuals, didn't get an adequate amount of limit setting. They weren't taught like when to stop, when to go, when too much is too much. And so we're fulfilling part of that, the work in schema therapy, which is really to try to meet that unmet need. But it's really hard if you're triggered to be able to remain persistent at saying, no, you're interrupting me again. You interrupted me again. And we talked about this, that when you do that, when you interrupt me, when I'm in the middle of speaking with you, that it, first of all, it throws me off. Second of all, it really feels very disrespectful. It's really hard for me to remain connected to you. I need you to work with me on this. I need you to stay with me, Joe. I need you to be my ally in this so we can fight that part of you that to some degree is impulsive and hasn't been well trained, to another degree is really trying not to feel things that are painful underneath. I get it, but you got to work with me.
Well, as you were speaking, I found myself wondering what it is that brings these people into treatment to begin with, because I'm thinking that this is not the type of person who is going to say of their own volition, gee, you know, things are not working in my life. I really better get some help. And so, as I say, I'm just wondering, do many of them come in voluntarily, or is it usually from some external force or person that's making them come in?
That's a really terrific question, Nora. And the majority of them will come into therapy because they've been threatened. They've been given an ultimatum. There's a consequence that they don't want to face, like losing a partner, losing a relationship with their child or their children, losing a job, losing a driver's license, something that they don't want to realize. And we call that leverage, right? If the consequence is meaningful enough, then the leverage will be good, meaning there's enough leverage to get them to come into therapy, maybe enough leverage if the therapist is postured to be able to deal with this type of client, enough leverage to keep them in therapy and to make it a good outcome. But very often the leverage is weak, meaning that the narcissistic individual may be clever enough to buy their way out of the situation with the DUI that they're facing, you know, the loss of their license or whatever other legal thing that may have come up that mandated treatment. They may be able to threaten their partner enough where a partner will retract the ultimatum for therapy because now they're frightened that they're going to lose custody of their children or lose financial security. So sometimes the leverage gets weakened because the narcissist will find ways of cleverly working their way out of it, or it's just not strong enough because they don't care enough. So for example, a partner who says, get help or get out, and the narcissistic individual is already, you know, engaged in an extramarital affair, has a big club of fans and followers, an entourage of people who are loyal to him, he may just say, fine, I'm going. So they leave. I mean, they won't leave usually unless they have that. They typically need to have something because, again, at the core of them, there's a lot of loneliness and emptiness. And I'm talking those that may be even very bright, brilliant, successful individuals. But, you know, emotionally speaking, there's so much loneliness that they don't usually leave unless they've already lined up a replacement of some kind, or they have enough people in their immediate circle that will keep them preoccupied for a period of time. So it does take leverage to get them come in. You know, there are some who will come to therapy on their own, usually those who are on the lower end of the scale of narcissistic personality. They may have less severe traits, or It might be that maybe for the first time in their life, they've experienced a panic attack, or they've had a medical diagnosis that is kind of taking them off their game, where for the first time, maybe in a lifetime since they were little, they have to count on people again because they have to fight for their life. And these can be circumstances and conditions under which they might enter therapy voluntarily. Depression, anxiety, things of that sort. They're not usually coming into therapy to look at the deeper issues. They're coming into therapy just to abate the uncomfortable symptoms so they can get back on track. And so they're typically not walking in poised to sit and really do the work in the way that would be most meaningful, meaning that they're getting into sustainable change that they can carry in an enduring way in their life. They're usually coming in looking for a quick fix. Even when they're coming in involuntarily, they want a quick fix. Tell me what to say. Tell me what to do. Tell me what I need to do to make this better, to get my partner off my back, to get my kids to come around. What do I need to do to get those morons at work to see that, you know, they're so lucky to have me instead of being so ungrateful and being so sensitive about everything I say? So they just want you to give them the tools, give them the words, give them the script. And they want to move on, tick the box and move on. And they're not usually very happy when I say things like, you know, get comfortable here. It's going to take a while. We've got some work to do.
You mentioned the phenomenon of triggering. And I was wondering if you could maybe say a little bit more about that, what it is, how can a therapist realize when it's happening, and is this something that is unique to working with narcissists?
It's definitely not unique to working with narcissists because we can be triggered under all kinds of conditions. I mean, narcissists are very triggering people. They trigger us. But there are so many different ways in which we can become triggered. The easiest way to think about it is if we think of our sensory system, right? We have experiences in our life that include smell, taste, touch, sound, kinesthetic feelings. We have feelings in our body. We have this sensory system that is, you know, amazing and magnificent and memorizes experiences and codes them in our brain. And under certain conditions, because we are humans, creatures that are constantly traveling around the universe, asking questions moment by moment without realizing it, what does that mean? What does that mean? What does that mean? What does that mean? And so sometimes it's very explicit, right? It's explicit. You're walking by the bake shop, you smell the apple pie, you know, the freshly baked apple pie, and oh, your senses are alive with joy, you know, remembering, maybe remembering even baking apple pies with your grandma when you were little, or eating apple pies at Thanksgiving, or just come alive with the triggering sensation of your mouth watering because you know the taste and you like the taste. In the same way that, you know, when I recall working once upon a time with a young man who had been a veteran in the Army, and, you know, he was sitting with me and a car backfired outside my window, and he nearly dove under the chair. You know, having a triggered, now we'd say that's a PTSD response, but what that means is he's highly triggered. There's something about the sound, not surprisingly, that alerts his fear system. And he's immediately reacting and responding to protect himself. So triggers can be implicit, you know, where we're just reacting. We don't know why we're reacting, but we're reacting. They can be explicit, where it's clear as a bell why we're having the reaction we're having. As I said, when I was working with narcissists, I looked at myself somewhat reflectively. Maybe it was just luck, but I was so shocked to say, what's with you? You know, you don't typically shy away from confrontation. You don't typically just give in. You know, you've overcome a lot of this. You've worked hard on this, Wendy, in therapy. You're not a person who just gives in to someone's unrealistic demands. And now you're feeling resentful about it. So I was very curious about my own reactions and realized I was getting triggered, meaning there was something about this experience that was reminiscent in my life and had me rendered to a time-warped state of mind. So when we're triggered, memory has been activated. For maybe a split second, we're in a time-warped state because we're remembering. And we may or may not know that we're remembering. Because so much of our reactions are on automatic pilot. And that's really what triggering is. It takes in the whole sensory system of what we see, of what we hear, of what we smell, of what we taste. And that's why it's more than just thoughts. It's so much more than thoughts because memory stores itself in so many ways.
So it sounds like kind of a very intense form of countertransference.
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely. In the therapy relationship, for sure. You know, that we say there's schema activation on both sides. And we are not going to, I mean, even to this day, and I'm many, many years, a couple of decades, more than that, into working with people with issues of narcissism, there's still days where I can find myself getting caught in a trigger. I mean, fortunately, I'm aware of it. And that's what we have to do, is really develop a keen awareness to what are our schemas, what are the conditions under which we're likely to be triggered, and be mindfully ready to notice those times and those conditions that we may not be anticipating where we would get triggered, but begin to be able to make sense out of that, reflect on that, resolve that once we realize that we've been activated.
So I have the impression that this calls for a lot of self-awareness on the part of the therapist in order to be able to deal with this.
Yeah, well, I think to be a really competent therapist, a really competent caregiver, which is what we're doing, we need to have a great degree of self-awareness. We need to know our own schemas. We need to know our own modes. How do we cope? I mean, schema modes are very fascinating because they include everything from our vulnerable states of mind, you know, our childlike states, which are natural and sometimes happy and playful, to our coping modes, which is like the survival system of fight and flight and freeze, to our internalized critical voices or punitive voices or demanding voices that may come from caregivers in our own once upon a time, to our healthy adult. So we have all these modes that are, you know, these states of mind that we move in and out of that are composed of schemas inside. And the more aware we can be of what are my schemas, even though I've become pretty good at, you know, not getting triggered, not getting activated, at not feeling the intensity, I've worked hard on this in therapy or supervision, says the therapist, even though I know that, I still want to be on the lookout when I'm with my clients for situations that would resonate in a way that can trigger me. And how will I know that? Well, I'll know that because I know things about the way when I feel like I'm saying something that isn't consistent with what I'm thinking in my mind or what I really want to say. So it doesn't really sound like me. It doesn't feel authentic. I know that I'm being triggered because I can feel it in my back, the tension, or in my stomach, that pit, or in my throat when it feels tight, or in my skin when it gets hot. I know it's probably a trigger because I have these reactions that are more intense that give me a sign. So the more aware we become, the more we're able to use that for referencing what it's like for others that are dealing with these clients, be it narcissists or others out there in the world. It's also a way for us to steady ourselves so that we can remain in our healthy adult modes. We have to be in our healthy adult modes in order to be competent caregivers. And a healthy adult mode informed by our vulnerability, because our vulnerability allows us to remember the world outside, that it's not just about the treatment room, it's about what's happening in the world outside for my client.
What if the client is not a narcissist themselves, but they are someone, say, who's in a relationship with a narcissist? And similarly, what if you are working with a couple or a family and you start to realize that one of the members of that unit is a narcissist? How would you proceed, or how would you recommend that a therapist proceed?
I think if you're working with a couple or a family and you begin to notice that one of the members is narcissistic, it's likely that you'll need to work with them or refer them individually for some individual therapy. It's pretty hard. I mean, again, it's not a one size fits all. I've certainly worked with couples where the one member of the relationship was narcissistic, but the other non-narcissistic partner was strong enough and sturdy enough to be able to withstand what was coming up in the therapy and allowing me to guide the process The problem is that for the person with NPD or some traits of narcissism, let's say, they just may really need that individual time in order to get past the facade, in order to go deeper. And they may not be willing to expose that to a partner. So it just depends on how willing they are to be vulnerable in front of their partner in the treatment room. Usually they're not. So it does require calling out or proposing some individual work for some period of time and maybe combining that with some intermittent couples work. I know a lot of therapists aren't comfortable with this kind of mix, but in schema therapy, we tend to find it more helpful to kind of keep it within the one system so that the language is consistent and the approach is consistent. And I get a lot of value out of having partners involved in the process of treatment with the narcissistic other.
What are some of the most significant obstacles to treatment? Other than, I know we've talked about a few of them already, but are there others that we haven't mentioned that you'd like to discuss?
Well, the biggest obstacles are that, I mean, some of it's just in the inherent makeup of someone with issues of narcissism, which is that they will deny that they have any emotional problems. They deny having deep emotional experiences. They'll deny being able to remember anything about their early life experiences. So it takes a lot of energy, a lot of work to be able to get past the wall that they'll usually put in place, or this kind of shiny, perfect childhood that they'll describe when you first begin exploring. That's hard. It's not impossible to get past it. It's not undoable. But again, it requires a lot of persistence, a lot of credibility, a lot of questions, a lot of sort of vivid exploration through imagery to get at. I use photographs. I collect photographs from them of their childhood, which can be very evocative for seeing their little self and sometimes helping me to get at the stories more organically of what it was like to be them in their early life. And that's always proven to be pretty amazing, you know, at bypassing their inhibitions and their guard that they put in place. So that's an obstacle in therapy. The other is, you know, the leverage, just as I said earlier, isn't high enough, or there isn't any leverage. So they'll come in maybe just to shut somebody up and move along and say they went to therapy, but they're not really in it. You know, they already have a foot out the door, perhaps. So leverage is a big issue, of course, as I've been talking about all through this time, Nora. It's the therapist's posture, you know, our own, not just the sturdiness, but really a sense of competence and understanding the complexities of narcissistic personality disorder. I mean, most of the literature and most therapists will say, oh, you can't treat them. They're hopeless. They're impossible. You know, just head for the hills. You can't work with them. And that can be, you know, somewhat comforting to say out loud because it's better than saying, I can't do it. And it's not exactly an untruth because they are difficult to treat. And even those that come in with high leverage, a therapist who's highly competent in treating them with a really good treatment approach that's proven effective, they can fall off the map. They can slip away. They can disappear. So it's a small percentage, I think, that will stay the course, that will make a meaningful difference, in that the therapy will make a meaningful difference, and they'll have some sustainable change in their relationships where it matters most. And that's always incredibly rewarding, but you've got to get past these obstacles of denial and dismissal and detachment and their criticalness and their controlling the therapy, their sense of entitlement around time and standards and how much time and how much they'll pay you. And there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of variables that are just inherent in their makeup.
You know, it's interesting, as you were talking, it occurred to me, if they do have a therapist who does just allow them to kind of slip away, as you said, or someone who does get so caught up in the achievement or the entitlement or the charm that in some ways that might just be reenacting and reconfirming what they experienced growing up in that, you know, being rewarded for those behaviors and getting the message that, you know, it's not who you really are. It's more about, you know, what you can achieve or how you can impress people or however you want to portray that.
That's exactly right. And that's unfortunately, sadly, what happens in a lot of the therapy that they experience. And that's, again, because the therapist either is, they're just missing it, which can happen. They're just sort of missing it. Some therapists are just so impressed because narcissists are so clever at coming in and being really charming and sweet. And they sort of know how to work their audience. And if you're not asking the questions, if you haven't had any contact with the partners or any of the family members, this is why it's so important to have contact. And you may get an exaggerated picture from a partner who also has perhaps some complex issues, but at least you get something. You want to have something to work with, and you need to be able to persist past the stories and the performance and the wonderful clothing that they're wearing and the amazing name dropping that they're doing or their sense of righteousness about this or that. It's easy to be intimidated. It's easy to be lured in. It's easy to be entertained by them. It's easy to be charmed. It's easy to sit back and let them talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and nod your head and move on until the clock strikes and you're done with the session. And as you said, and you're right, you're colluding. You know, you're colluding with the kind of setup that's been there in place for them their whole life. Colluding with this idea that the only thing they have to do is win approval and perform at their best, and that's all they need. And it doesn't change anything in the places where they're struggling the most. You know, it doesn't change anything in terms of their relationship. I mean, I'm not interested in making my client a better banker or a better surgeon or a better lawyer. I wouldn't know the first thing about how to do that. Many of them seem to be fairly upstanding because so much focus is on their performance. But I do know something about how to help them to be better at engaging in relationship, because they're in a relationship with me in the therapy relationship. And although it's different, we do get more than just a small glance at what it might be like for others who are in relationship. And I can hear about that if I invite partners to have some voice in this process.
Where can someone learn more about schema therapy if they're interested?
Well, there's a number of different places. They can certainly, if they're interested in learning about schema therapy vis-a-vis narcissism, they can read my book, which is Disarming the Narcissist. If they're interested in learning about schema therapy, there's the Handbook of Schema Therapy, the Practitioner's Guide, which was written by Jeffrey Young and Janet Klosko and others. They certainly can go to the schema therapy. There are several websites. We have an International Society of Schema Therapy that is chock full of information. My website, disarmingthenarcissist.com, has a lot of information on where to learn about schema therapy, both professional training as well as reading resources on my site. So that's a little something.
All right. Well, Wendy Bahari, thank you so much for telling us about narcissists and how to disarm them.
My pleasure, Nora. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Ms. Bahari. And that concludes this edition of Audio Digest Psychology. Our thanks to Wendy Bahari for her cooperation in the production of this issue. For information about upcoming meetings around the country, visit our website, audiodigest.org, and click on the Inside Audio Digest tab at the top of the page on your dashboard. This program is copyright 2018.